Radio Catskill.
Say you've been married a long time. What do you do when the magic stops working? On this week's Selected Shorts, that question is literal, as we hear fiction about an aging magician and the wife who vows to protect him, read by Jane Curtin. I'm Meg Wolitzer. Join me.
Selected Shorts, Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Jeff. Join me Saturday at midnight for Electric Mountain. 2 hours of house, techno, indie dance, and more, plus sets by top local, New York City, and global guest DJs. From the underground to the highest peak, it's Electric Mountain, Saturday at midnight on Radio Catskill.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Each week, I introduce you to the fabulous characters of the Catskills and beyond. If you've ever been to the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan, you probably remember their fantastic dioramas of animals in their natural habitats. But have you ever wondered how they were made? It takes a broad team of professionals, scientists, artists, and craftspeople working in the field and at the museum to conserve a piece of nature for the world to enjoy. Our guest today is George Dante. As a prominent taxidermist, he spent years working on restoring those historic dioramas at the museum. But as he did that work, he realized that even people at the museums didn't know much about how they were originally built. To make sure the skills and history involved in this type of work can be preserved and shared, George founded the Institute of Natural History Arts, of which he is also the president. Let's meet a true Catskill character, George Dante, in conversation with Radio Catskill's Jason Dole.
Let's just start off with your early life. Can you talk about where you grew up and how you got started in life?
Yeah. I grew up in a working class family in urban New Jersey, just 20 minutes outside of Manhattan, and was a naturalist as a kid. So I was always outside studying nature. My family, always had me at zoos and museums. And I fell in love with just nature and the art forms of drawing and painting and sculpting. My mother was a stay-at-home mom, and my father owned a contracting business. My father's a civil engineer, a contractor. And, my family were all very artistic and very talented. So I come from a long line of very talented people, whether it be different mediums of artwork, also carpenters, cabinet makers. My father was one of those guys that he can, and still to this day, can do just about anything: masonry, carpentry, cabinet making. And that's what helped me. I had relatives that knew how to paint, relatives that knew how to sculpt, and that really shaped me as a person growing up, as a young artist.
So it sounds like you're surrounded by people, even at an early age, who not just have specific artistic skills, but are hands-on people. Like, there's that concept, you can make something,
yes.
You can do something, you can create something to change something, which isn't always the message that working class people get when they're growing up. So that's amazing that you had that. Can you tell me a little bit of, like you say, you have like relatives that like painted and stuff like that. Do you remember like seeing their artwork or anything as a little kid?
Absolutely. And none of them were professionals. They were all hobbyists. And I remember just seeing, simple stuff. I remember I had an aunt that was an amazing seamstress and loved to crochet and did a lot of ceramics. And I had an uncle that was basically retired and did an amazing amount of woodworking. I mean, he would sit me up on his workbench during the day because he was disabled, so he couldn't work anymore. So he was with me every day, all day. I would spend all day in his workshop. And if we weren't in his workshop, we were at a zoo. So he would set me up on his workshop and I would sit on his workbench and he would have me there with a hammer and nails, just hammering nails all day. But showing me the right way to hammer nails, put them in straight. What happens if they bend? Well, how do you pull them out now? Things like that. It was that hands-on mentorship that really shaped me as a person today. And that's something I feel like we're losing today, is that mentorship and of course that hands-on work. They always invited me in to do this. You know, when I was trying to, you know, build these little displays as a kid, they all watched and they all came in. Hey, you could do this, and here, let me show you how to do this. That's what was just remarkable. And I would never be sitting here talking to you today if I didn't have that.
Wow. Can you tell me a little bit about how you made your way to the Catskills? And do you even remember when you first came to the Catskills?
I do. So I grew up also in a sporting family. You know, we enjoyed the outdoors. We like to spend time in the outdoors, hunting, fishing. So my father was looking for a weekend place, and we had found this piece of property. And I remember coming here as a kid, sitting in the back seat of the car. I was 10 years old, looking at this place, thinking, you know, this is insane. This, our first piece of property, you know, where we are, was 169 acres. And I'm like, you know, what do you even do with this? You know, how do you even get around it? And he bought this place, and we started coming up here, and it was just paradise to me. Absolute paradise. You know, I couldn't wait to get up here, and I couldn't stand going back home. When I was in high school, as I grew up, you know, I would start to drive up here on my own and just absolutely fell in love with it. You know, when you're here on a piece of property, especially if it's your own property, there's this incredible free feeling, and you're surrounded by nature and clean air. And it's just, how do you not fall in love with the Catskills?
I hear you there.
And the beauty of it, right. The beauty of this is, you know, I live about 3 hours from here, 2.5, 3 hours from here. And it's far enough away to where you feel like you're away, but it's close enough to where, you know, I've run up here for the day.
Far enough where you feel like you're getting away. It's close enough to actually get away, you know.
Exactly.
Is that what your father was looking for when you got there? It was just like a place to recreate, get the kids, or was it, you know, like for hunting? Was it for all of that? Was that the appeal?
It was everything. Yeah. My father loved the outdoors, and my father grew up in Newark, New Jersey. And he looks at this place today, and still, you know, my father's 82 years old, and he walks around here and he's like, I still can't believe that I have this. And this is still, you know, one of our most favorite places to come to. And as I got older and met my wife and got married, never thought that she would love this as much as she does, and never thought my kids would love this as much as they do. And, you know, some people don't have that. And now we are closer to this community than we are to ours at home. You know, my neighbors at home, I don't see very often. Our community at home is very widespread because we're in the city. Everybody's busy. Everybody's working. Here, I'm amazed at this community.
When did you actually get into taxidermy, and was the hunting that the family is doing part of that as well?
Ironically, it wasn't. The taxidermy drew me in as an art form. So I love spending time in the outdoors, whether it was hunting or fishing. But that I always kept that very separate to me. I was always drawing animals as a kid, always drawing animals. And I used to, you know, use reference from books or bird watching outside. And then when I was very young, 7 years old, I read this book on taxidermy and just fell in love with this art form. And, you know, I had, you know, always been going to the Museum of Natural History as a kid, as most kids do, looking at those dioramas. When my parents took me to the museum, I was absolutely floored at those dioramas. They just blew me away. It was, you know, the animals, the landscapes, the plants, everything. It was just this incredible scene that just took my breath away, and always wanted to build them. You know, started with like shoebox dioramas as a kid, and just fell in love with this. But I painted, I sculpted, I continued with artwork, and the taxidermy is just another form of artwork.
I'll never forget seeing the Museum of Natural History for the first time. Those nature dioramas were like they were like a window into a whole other reality.
Exactly. And that's exactly what they were intended to do. They were intended to transport you to these different places. And remember, these were built at a time when, you know, we didn't have elaborate television, we didn't have the internet or anything like that. So these were designed to transport people that may have never had the opportunity to travel. They wanted to make people aware of the wildlife and the ecosystems that these artists knew were going to disappear from early on. They realized our planet was changing, and that these, we were going to have an impact on this planet, and things were not going to be the same. And that was their mission, to build these dioramas.
Well, I think a lot of people, if you think taxidermy, I think they're thinking of, like trophy hunting. It's also interesting that the work that you do is it's not about collecting trophies. It's about the conservation aspect of it. It's about preserving and documenting and communicating wildlife to other people.
Absolutely. That's what drew me to it. That's what drew me. It was the diorama as a whole. That's what drew me to it. And that's what it's all about. It's about connecting people with nature. It's about conservation.
Can you tell me about like the first work that you started doing in this field? And then we could talk about the work that you do now.
Sure. So when I was very young, I had tried to go to local taxidermy studios and offer my services to work for them for free as an apprentice. At that time, it was very closed off. They would not let me in there. You know, it was very secretive. They were very protective of their craft, of their art form, and of their business. So that was a dead end for me. So I just continued to practice this on my own. And when I was in high school, I felt I was good enough to start my own business, and started my taxidermy business while I was in high school. And it was servicing anyone I could find. It was the hunting community, the fishing community. I was restoring pieces that people had around their house that needed repairs, things like that. But in the back of my mind, I had always wanted something more. I always wanted to do museum work. I always felt like that's where I was meant to be. And it wasn't until, I had met a very good friend and a mentor in the business, and he had taken me to the Museum of Natural History, and he said, "Do you really want to work and do this type of work?" And I said, "More than anything in the world." And he said, "Well," he said, "call this guy, Stephen C. Quinn, who was the head of the exhibition department at the American Museum of Natural History at that time." And I had sent him a portfolio. And I remember getting a phone call from him one day, hearing his voice on my answering machine. Remember those? and being so intimidated. And he said, "I've seen your portfolio. I'd like to come see some of your work in person." Now I'm freaking out. I don't have a studio. I'm working out of my parents' basement, like all good companies start, right? He's going to come to my parents' house, come down to their basement, and that's going to be the end of this. That's going to be the end of this dream, because no one's going to take this seriously. But he did. He came down and he saw the work, and he was looking at some of my fish work, and he said, "Do you mind if I take one of these back to the museum to show a few people?" And I'm like, "Well, this is unexpected." And he did. And I remember him calling me a few days later and saying, "We're working on the restoration of the whole of ocean life, and we'd like for you to start working on some of those pieces for that project." And I was absolutely blown away, absolutely floored. I remember just, like you could hear the angels singing. it was that crazy.
How old were you? Do you remember what age were you?
I was out of college already. I was out of college at that
time. Like in your early 20s.
Yes. I was out of college, and I, from that project, it just snowballed. And then, we started doing, after that job, we did more jobs for them. And I was never a staff person. I was always a contractor, subcontractor for them. Their last staff taxidermist at the American Museum was David Schwendeman, and he had retired. So I was just a contractor, But, you know, then we started working for other museums and then more museums, and it just snowballed from there.
You're listening to a conversation with George Dante, founder and president of the Institute of Natural History Arts. There's more of this conversation to come, so stay with us on Catskill Character.
The Dirty Dancing Concert returns on September 6th, now in a ballroom theater just like the movie finale, with songs from the movie performed by a live band so audiences can sing along, dress up, and dance. Featuring music of the Shirelles, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, Sam Cooke, and many more. Dirty Dancing Concert, September 6th at 7:30 at the Delaware Valley Opera in Lake Huntington. Tickets and information at MyRiverTickets.com. Paid for by Razzmatazz Incorporated.
And there, I'm Jason Dole, reminding you that Radio Catskills Music Yard Sale returns next Saturday, September 5th, Labor Day weekend, at our Liberty Studios on Route 52. And there is still time to donate your music collection. Get it in the hands of the next generation of fans and support a great cause. Or just come by and get vinyl records, CDs, cassette stereos, and turntables for yourself. It's Radio Catskills Music Yard Sale, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. next Saturday at our Liberty Studios. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg. Today we're exploring the intersections of science, art, craftsmanship, and conversation with George Dante, founder and president of the Institute of Natural History Arts. In the first half of the program, we learned about George's path to becoming a taxidermist. Now we'll hear about the work the Institute is doing today in New Jersey and the Catskills. Here's George Dante speaking with Radio Catskills' Jason Dole.
So I'm still a full-time artist. We're still creating and building and restoring natural history exhibits. And we have a studio in Woodland Park, New Jersey. That's our headquarters. And the way this all developed was, you know, we started the Institute because we were doing a lot of jobs restoring historic natural history dioramas. And I've noticed when we came on site, you know, we would all gather in front of these dioramas and, you know, everybody would kind of, you know, talk and say, you know, well, we wonder how they did this. There was always questions. And I realized, even though museums do have incredible archives, no one really organized this. And no one really kind of served this to the public in a way that they can appreciate it more on how these were built. You know, museums do great jobs of exhibiting this material. They do great jobs even talking about it sometimes. There's small exhibits that highlight the behind the scenes, but I really wanted to record the history of these people, what they did. I wound up meeting a lot of amazing people. Stephen C. Quinn is one of those people. The gentleman that gave me my start became my mentor in the history of these dioramas. And many others like him came on later. And I said, man, what these people know is incredible. And it's not written down anywhere. You know, the knowledge they have in their head is going to be lost forever someday. And that scared the hell out of me. So I said, we need to do something. So I started it in the studio in New Jersey. We started forming this. We wanted it to be education-based, and we wanted to start building a collection of artifacts that would actually help people visualize how this was built. The old plant molds, the old taxidermy molds. So you can come to our studio, look at these, and you're like, oh, that's how it's done. The Catskill portion of this was really interesting because we started talking about, all right, how did all this material get back to the museum? Started with an expedition. People went into the field. And I said, wouldn't it be cool if we could build something on this property to where people could come and experience that? Because again, we take for granted that how did this material get from the field to the museum? If you go in the back room of a scientific department at the museum, you'll open up drawers of study skins, you know, birds, mammals, you know, how do they get there? Well, some of these study skins go back to the 1700s and 1600s. Expeditions that people died on. They worked in horrible conditions to get these specimens back so that we can open up a drawer and pull out a bird skin. These were the things that really kind of made me say, you know, how can we do this in the Catskills? How can we bring people up here and give them that immersive experience? And that's how this was born.
And you do an annual field days. So that's literally you get people in the field to do that. How long have you been doing that for?
So the field days, this is the first one. This is the first event we're holding. So we, for the past several years, we've been holding an ornithology class here where we teach people about a historic bird collecting expedition. So we take them into the field on the property, and we have little cabins set out around the property where we can do sections of the class at each cabin, have students working outside in the field, teaching them hands-on so that they gain that appreciation for it. And that has been very popular. Field days came about by us saying, how can we increase this? How can we show them the whole run of it, not just the ornithology, but everything? So in our last board meeting, it was our board that came up with this idea. Hey, let's do this event where they come onto the location, come into the field, and watch all the disciplines working. So you'll have the ornithologist working out there, showing you how he prepared bird specimens. You'll have the mammalogist working out there, showing how he would collect mammals and what they do today. You have the background artist on site doing a background painting. You have the foreground artist building the scale model of a diorama. You have the plant person, the botanical artist, showing us how you would collect plants, how you'd make plaster molds. Herpetologist talking about reptiles and amphibians, how they were collected historically, what kind of research is done today. So you have all these disciplines in one location showing you kind of what they would have done on expeditions years ago versus kind of what they do today.
I can't help but contrast this work that you're doing, which is, it's about preserving the history of people who preserved nature and the work that they did, but it's also about preserving and transmitting the skill sets that allowed it to happen in the first place, making sure that these practices, these crafts aren't lost. And I can't help but contrast that with you. You had this burning interest in this type of work and couldn't even do a free internship with commercial taxidermists because, you know, people are protective of what they need to make a living. But that's how you lose skills from one generation to another. So I can't help but contrast that experience you had as a young man with this work that you're doing now. Do you ever think about that?
I do, and I appreciate that. Yeah, it's, you know, this has become so multifaceted. I'm like, you know, we're losing the art form. We're losing the people. You know, we have people that have been lost already that had so much to share with us. So, you know, it's kind of expedited this whole thing. You know, I thought this was something to do kind of leisurely, and now it's become, you know, quite time sensitive. You know, we need to do this now. We are so fortunate to have people that still know about these historic practices, and we need to record this information. And we need to create mentorship again. We really need to get people into conservation, into hands-on work by mentorship programs. And that's what we're trying to do. We're open, you know, when we talk about students, it's open to anyone, 8 to 80. And what I love is that our classes so far have been filled with both the general public and museum professionals. Museum professionals that work in these institutions say, hey, you know, I want to know a little bit more about how these exhibits were created. I walk past these every day, but kind of took them for granted myself. I want to know a little bit more about the history. And they come to us, and we absolutely love that. That's all we're trying to do, is preserve this.
Is there anything else that you've been so generous with your time and telling us so much information. Is there anything that you wanted folks to know that we didn't get to?
No, I think it's basically just appreciating dioramas and natural history exhibits as an art form. You know, these art forms will never never fade away. There's a lot of thoughts today that we wonder, are dioramas still relevant? You know, we have so much technology at our fingertips today. Well, it's actually, they're becoming more relevant than we think they are, because we are bombarded with technology today. You know, we're on our screens constantly. We're on our screens during the day for work. We're on our screens at night for pleasure. We are constantly living in this two-dimensional world. You know, dioramas, you know, basically break that barrier, and we're allowed to stand in front of that. And it's, you know, even though it's behind glass, it's tactile. We're looking at, you can see the textures of these animals. You can look at the leaves. You can see these animals, you know. We were very fortunate enough to meet George Schaller, who's, you know, an amazing naturalist. And George Schaller, you know, studied mountain gorillas. I mean, you know, Diane Fossey quotes George Schaller. Most of her work comes from George Schaller's work. And I remember him saying, you know, about natural history dioramas are an amazing way to look at wildlife. I'm like, wow, that's interesting. You spent your whole life in the field studying wildlife. And he's like, well, you know, he's basically to the fact that, you know, when you're studying wildlife in the field, you know, you're intruding on wildlife. So you're basically in that world and you're intruding on them. And, you know, you have to be very careful of that. He said, if you want to really study wildlife, you know, where you're not encroaching on anything and see animals in their natural habitat, he said, you could look at a natural history diorama, at a good natural history diorama. So we don't think these will ever be irrelevant because of that.
The Institute for Natural History Arts is online at naturalhistoryarts.org. That's naturalhistoryarts.org. We've been talking to its president and founder, George Dante. George, are there other places on the web where people can follow what you do or get a hold of you if they need to?
Well, if they check out our website, you know, naturalhistoryarts.org, you know, that's a good place to stay in contact with us. You know, where you could also find the Institute for Natural History Arts on Instagram and Facebook and kind of stay up to date on what we're doing. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions and ideas and ways we can better this, you know, we're trying to build a community. We want to build a community of people who love this. So we'd love to hear from you.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us today. This has been fabulous.
Thank you. We really appreciate this.
You've been listening to a conversation with George Dante, founder and president of the Institute of Natural History Arts. I want to thank Radio Catskills' Jason Dole for bringing us this conversation today. I'm certainly going to have a lot more to think about the next time I see one of those nature exhibits in a museum. But for now, that's it for this week's show. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thank you so much for listening this morning, and please join me again next week for more conversations with fabulous characters of the Catskills and beyond, here on Catskill Character.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from King Pizza Records, a New York-based DIY rock and roll label focused on creating community through music. King Pizza is a pizza party for the garage or basement. They serve up fuzz, reverb, and earworm melodies in multiple genres. More information at kingpizzarecords.com and on Bandcamp, Facebook, and Instagram. From generous funding from the Public Media Bridge Fund. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Recently on Wait, Wait, Sally Field winced as she remembered her stint as the Flying Nun.
I had this harness with wires coming out of the habit. I was on a 50-foot crane some of the times, and they would fly me into the side of a building.
I'm Peter Sagal. Stay grounded when you listen to this week's show with panelists Peter Gross, Joelle Nicole Johnson, and Tig Notaro. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Early radio enthusiasts discovered something about shortwave broadcasting.
Radio waves are sent out in all directions.
That was different from AM and FM.
When these waves strike the antenna of a receiving set, we hear sound originating at that very moment, hundreds or even thousands of miles away.
Long live the shortwaves on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.